And as usual, we'll begin with the hotline tapes. This evening, before beginning the Bible study, we have the two Pastor General's hotline tapes which were played on the Watts lines this week. The first one is by Mr. Raymond McNair. There is the promise of his coming. And the second one will be by Mr. Takach, and after that we'll have the Bible study.
Greetings. This is Raymond McNair speaking for Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong on the Pastor General's hotline. Mr. Armstrong is doing just fine in Tucson, having visited with the second and final group of sabbatical ministers Tuesday. The three-hour meeting capped a beautiful buffet luncheon, and following the meeting, the entire group returned to Pasadena in the G2, which Mr. Armstrong had asked them to come down in. Here in Pasadena, most of the new field assignments and transfers have been made, with a few yet to come. All in all, there will be around 50 moves taking place almost immediately, with 15 to 20 more moves possible during the coming year. As a sidelight, you may have noticed the Ford commercial starring Peter Graves. In case you haven't noticed, the setting is at night in front of the auditorium and egret fountain here in Pasadena. The setting was in front of God's house, but I don't believe the LTD is God's car. Anyway, you may want to watch for the commercial. Here at Ambassador, the first session to be held in the decade of the 1980s is now underway. The spring semester began January 14th with 430 students. This is about 20 students more than we had last semester. 21 former students have returned to finish their education, and approximately 22% of the student body is comprised of international students. This year, we have a student-faculty ratio of around 16-1, and if part-time faculty members were included, the ratio would be even less. Mr. Armstrong is very pleased with the direction the college is now taking, and as Mr. Dick Ames said a couple of weeks ago, quote, "We as faculty members are proud to be a part of the West Point of God's Church," end quote. I might also hasten to add that many do not know or have not known that Ambassador is accredited. We are the only college or university that is accredited by the highest accreditation bureau of all. We are fully accredited by God. As another interesting item, watch for Sports Illustrated's January 14th edition. The track and field section gives the college some excellent publicity. The article includes comments from former world high jump champion Dwight Stones regarding the track and field here in Pasadena. On other news, we have been having extremely wet weather here in Pasadena, mudslides and flooding, which have not as yet affected God's brethren here locally. In other parts of the country, brethren have not fared so well. We need to take warning as members of God's church. The Bible plainly speaks of upset weather conditions along with other natural disasters. With the terrible snows in the Seattle area recently and the hurricanes earlier this year, it serves as a constant reminder to each of us to pray daily for our brothers and sisters around the world, keeping close to God, and He will be our protector and comforter. I would like to close with a scripture from 1 Corinthians 15:58. Quote, "Therefore, my beloved brethren," or I might say, "my beloved fellow ministers, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, forasmuch as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord." End quote. Until next time, this is Raymond McNair saying so long for now.
Greetings. This is Joe Takach speaking for Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong on the Pastor General's hotline. Having returned from Tucson yesterday after an all-day meeting with Mr. Armstrong, I can report he is in excellent shape. It seems that God has shown him the fountain of youth. He is getting stronger each day and is tackling all of his work with an ever-increasing enthusiasm. Several items were discussed, and Mr. Armstrong has asked that several ministers from Pasadena again begin visiting the churches across the nation. He further went on to add that he would have to fly to the various areas aboard the G-2 aircraft. The first trip should be in mid-February, with the itinerary to be announced later. Brethren, I sincerely hope you fully realize what Christ is doing through Mr. Armstrong. He wants all of us to speak with one accord, and indeed, if we are of like spirit and like mind, we will. In Pasadena, things are hectic on this Super Bowl weekend, but the work is running smoothly with Mr. Armstrong's January 5th anniversary sermon to be mailed shortly. A mechanical breakdown with the television truck on the way back from Tucson slowed the mailing up a little, but it should be reaching you shortly. Also here in Pasadena, the new ministerial training program is coming along on schedule, with many very good and very helpful suggestions being sent in from the field ministry. The first worldwide news of the 1980s promises to be one of the best and most inspiring of the new decade. This issue, dated January 14th, offers coverage of several important news items, including details of the new ministerial training program, the approval of plans for YES, and the elevation of Mr. Harold Jackson to the rank of evangelist. Also included is an interview with Mr. Rader on various aspects of Mr. Armstrong's trips abroad to preach the gospel, and a special group of articles on the church's legal situation 1 year from the state's unconstitutional siege. If this fine issue is an indication of what to expect from the worldwide news in the 1980s, we, as brethren, can be very encouraged and enthusiastic about our own church newspaper. That about wraps it up for today, except to add that we should continue in our uphill fight toward the kingdom. As you all well know, God never said it was going to be easy, and we need to remember without God's help we won't make it. This is Joe DeConte saying, so long for now.
Before I get into the Bible study, I have two more announcements here, or just one actually. And that is the announcement that was made before from the announcement bulletin. As you all know, brethren, meeting here in this auditorium, we are meeting in the finest facility on the face of this earth. Each one of us must do his part in properly caring for the auditorium. There are many fine things that could be damaged easily or destroyed by careless or soiled hands. We ask no one touch the gold leaf on the underside of the stairs. It is very fragile and easily damages. Look, but please do not touch. Two family rooms at the lower level of the auditorium are available for infants and small children. Very small children should not be fed, tended to, or bedded down in the men's sitting area of the auditorium. Due to the danger of accidents, dropped bottles, wet diapers, etc., on the velvet, upholstery, or wool carpets, we kindly request parents accompany their children to the restrooms. The soap leaf dispensers tend to be a popular toy for our youngsters. Gum should be discouraged for youngsters, and finally we request that all seats having reserved or occupied signs remain reserved. Please do not remove these signs. Thank you most kindly for your cooperation and understanding. Together we can enjoy the best services ever in the best facility on earth. And there is a brochure that you can all get outside if you don't have. It looks like that. I believe there is another type that looks green. It's exactly the same, and if you don't have it, it would be appreciated if you will get one outside of the lobby. I have no announcements about somebody shining lights, so would you please all go check your lights and see if they are shining. Before I start the Bible study, well, first maybe I should mention that since I started late, I may have to go a little bit late, and according to one of the deacons here at least, he told me that I can go at least until 10 o'clock. I don't plan to go that far, but I told him I'll have to have two Bible studies, one right now and one as soon as I finish. But I promised a friend of mine that gave me a ride yesterday that I should let him out before 9:30 for his TV watch. I'd like to extend my appreciation first to Mr. John Halford and Stephanie. They are working very hard, and you don't know that until you work with them. Sometimes I wonder if they eat. Now, tonight, as you heard before in the announcement last week, we'll have the missing dimension in the Middle East conflict subject that would be discussed. And if by now you did not detect an accent in my voice, it would be discussed from an Israeli point of view. Israelis sound different, you know. I would start with the slides. It would be about 24 or 22 slides that will give you a background that will set the mood for the subject and lead us in the right direction. You may not realize or fully understand what is the connection between all of them, but by the time I finish the subject, I hope all of you would know what it is all about. Now, one thing I'd like to mention, I may have plenty of details, and the reason is I'm painting a picture. Don't worry about the details, just get the picture. And most of the time you will have the lights on, so you would be able to take notes anyway, and they shouldn't be that difficult. If you just write down the scriptures and read them, they tell the story from the point of view of God, and that's the way I would read most of it. So keep in mind the scenes and the personalities in the slides throughout the Bible study. I would not rehash all the stories, the articles, the statements, the news media stories, and everything else that you've had before in the past many years about the Middle East. We all know that too well, and I hope that at least you will bring it to mind when you look through this subject and fill up the background. If you all read the December 79 article in the Plain Truth about the Middle East, you have a lot of background about this subject. It was a very excellent one. And one more point I should mention before we start the slides, and I'd like you to remember that throughout the Bible study and later on when you meet me in the auditorium or in a dark alley. The Middle East issue is a personal and emotional issue to every Israeli and to every person in the Middle East. It is not just a political issue or something you study about that is very interesting, that you hear about it here and there. It is not just because prophecy is exciting. It is a personal and emotional issue because you live it. Everybody is affected by it in the Middle East. It's a part of your life. I was born and raised in the Middle East, in one of the Arab countries. It used to be a British colony called Aden. I lost two members of my family in that part of the world. Both of them were murdered. And many of my relatives were either shot or murdered. Many of them were dismembered and stuck in barrels. It seems to be as a hobby of certain Arabs. And many other relatives and friends and neighbors in that part of the country, in Israel later on, died in the battles. And I have to be subjective or objective, rather. A Palestinian can tell you exactly the same things that I'm telling you now. And I'd like to be balanced for their sake also, in that sense at least. On a personal basis, the Arabs are not worse or better than the Israeli or the Israelites. And that means every single one person, you know, every single person here or even in other nations. They're very charming people, very lovable. And if I may mention that, I told it one time to Dr. Meredith when I used to assist him in the LA church. We were discussing the Middle East, and he was telling me about a certain person from the Middle East, from Palestine, as he called it, or from East Jerusalem, that was telling him about all the things that he lost in that part of the country and probably many relatives that were lost in war. And I told him that as far as I'm concerned, and I don't want that, I want anybody to get it wrong, I feel more comfortable with an Arab than with an American. And what I meant by that, of course, I feel comfortable with Americans, but more comfortable with the Middle Easterns. The same way that you would say I feel comfortable with all the brethren, but more comfortable with my, you know, your wife or your brother or sister. simply because of the mentality and the culture and the background and the emotions, which are the same. Nothing to do with hating one or loving the other. Just a natural thing. I grew up in that part of the country. I know the people. I know their mentality. And if you know the Middle Easterns by now, especially after you've seen in Iran, you know that they've got a great capacity for hatred, but they also have a great capacity for love and affection and affinity and warmth. As a matter of fact, I met a lady here in Pasadena, and she's a Palestinian, and I told her that she detected that I am from the Middle East also. She didn't realize that I was an Israeli. Like most Arabs that I meet here and there, they all insist that I'm a Palestinian myself. And I told her that I was born in Aden, and the first word she said is, in Arabic, Bahibak, which means in English, I love you. Now, my wife doesn't worry about that because she's about 60 years old. And at least three times my size also. But a very lovable woman. And that's what I mean about the affection and the warmth and the great capacity for showing emotions. And with that, I feel very comfortable. Now, I had many friends in many parts of Israel, Arab friends. I loved very much. I had them in Paris when I lived there for a few years. And I had them here in New York, where I lived before, and I had them here. So I'm saying all these things because we have Arab friends and Palestinians also in the congregation, in the Church of God, and I would like everybody to feel comfortable with the subject. I'm separating the man from the sin, and I'm talking about it from the point of view of God, in the same way that I hope all of you by now, you are all able to separate between the righteous or the Jewish Pharisee and his hypocrisy. See, there is a difference. I can talk about both. So I'd like you to think about it from this point of view as I read through it. And beside most of the things that I would be reading, God said them. And blame him for that, not me. So we'll proceed now with the slides. Just look through them. I'm going to make about one comment or two about each. Try to go as fast as possible. I have an awful lot of material, about 3,800 years material. So bear with me, and I'll go through it in Tebby style. The Mideast conflict. This is our subject, and I'm sure that everybody heard about it and saw a lot about it in the past many years. Somebody with a green Buick station wagon, 562-HZO, California plates. You know the message. The plain truth about the explosive Middle East, it says a lot in one picture. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, a city that meant so much for so many people, for so many nations and religions, and so much happened there. You know one of them at least. Our apostle, Mr. Armstrong, as he was in Jerusalem with the mayor of Jerusalem. He had many meetings over there. We contributed to the Liberty Bell Park. I've been there in February of last year. A very nice place. Peace in the Middle East. What is that? I'm sure all Americans know who that person is. You see Arafat there, and you see Khomeini right on top of him. Is it a strange coincidence that they have such an alliance? As seen in the Middle East, it is an impasse. That means nobody can pass through as long as a soldier is there. Three persons from the past, Nasser, Hussein, and Arafat. The picture tells about an alliance, many alliances in the Middle East for a certain purpose, generally destruction of the state of Israel and the repossession of Palestine. The present prime minister begging that began to give an awful lot to the Egyptians and is willing to give to others, but he might also end it. You all know that person? He happened to be my cousin, Arafat. Remember that the Middle East is an emotional issue. It is also a family issue. And there is a cousin of mine and a cousin of all the Israelites. I would like to stress the family ties. They are very important. The struggle for Palestine, and you notice I underlined Palestine. That's the only name he knows. There is an uncle there from Manasseh, Uncle Carter. Uncle Sadat and Uncle Begin. It is not a joke, it's a reality. They are. And they behave like uncles also. Sadat and the president of Syria, Assad, and the third one, Muammar Gaddafi. And Gaddafi has an awful lot to say about the Middle East. Mainly he liked Israel destroyed. And of course, that is another alliance. And the purpose of the alliance at that time, which was a few years ago, was only one. The destruction of the state of Israel and the repossession of Palestine. Dome of the Rock, as we know it in English, it has another name in Israel or in the Middle East. I'll refer to that later. What is it doing there? Two of the peacemakers of this world, Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Rader, but unfortunately the way of peace, the other side does not know. Queen Elizabeth with the scepter and the birthright recipient. What is the connection of that lady? Happened to be Jewish. I happen to be Jewish. I was born in a British colony and I happen also to be a British subject. So Her Majesty, my Queen, Elizabeth. The present Prime Minister of Britain, Thatcher, Margaret Thatcher. Now you all know this map. This is the map of US and BC possessions and the birthright. It has an awful lot to do with the Middle East. There you can see in the center the map of the oil nations of the Middle East. At the time you see the arrow pointing to the United States. They sold us only about 3 to 4%. That was in 72, I believe. Today it is about 50% or something close to that. It's quite a difference in about 8 years. And this is what they have to sell us, and this is a part of the Middle East conflict. There you see the king, the former king of Saudi Arabia, the major oil producer of the Middle East. He's also an uncle. And there you see Palestinian refugees. Now, I would like you to keep in mind these slides throughout this study to gain the real and full perspective behind the conflict in the Middle East. It is very important. Now, the Middle East conflict, as I said before, is above all, or most of all, is an emotional family squabble over the inheritance, and it is also a story of defiance that we will see as we go through the Bible study. I would be reading an awful lot because I've written this whole study in a sort of an oracle type. There is so much to say, and unless I write it down, I'll be straying in all directions. As I said, there is so much to tell, especially when you live there. So I would be reading an awful lot And later on we'll have the scriptures, and you will be reading with me. Now, in the Middle East, we see the sudden rise to world prominence and power of the Middle Eastern nations, which a short 50 years ago, or even less, had very little impact on the world scene. They had very little influence on world politics and economy of the free world. Yet suddenly, in the last days, in which we are now, we see many of the Middle Eastern nations armed with a powerful and deadly weapon, oil. The Middle Eastern nations who happened, that is quote-unquote, happened to be among the world's largest oil-producing countries have also the power to determine the economic and social fate of many nations, and particularly those of the West, and even the U.S. They can destroy many economies, and they hold even the giant U.S. at bay through the lethal weapons of oil, petrodollars, gold, and silver. The nations of the Middle East possess now the most sophisticated weapons that the West has to offer, and for that matter, even the Russians. All the big powers have sent their arms to that part of the country or the world. Their arsenal can rival that of all NATO allies combined. That's how much they have. The Middle East has aged our world to within an inch of a nuclear holocaust. A nation like Iran can throw the giant U.S. into a state of helplessness and hold it captive at will, and in a sense still does. Now, from a biblical point of view, let's ask the following questions. Why do the nations of the Middle East, such as Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, Libya, the Persian Gulf Emirates and states, Egypt, Syria, and Algeria, have come to possess such a vast wealth at this critical time of this world? And that is the end time. Why do they have the fattest piece or pieces of real estate? In other words, the land that they have is very fat because of what's in it. Why do they have such huge oil reserves, which cause the wealth of the West to be shifted and flow into their coffers at the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars in the last short few years? The world's rapidly diminishing gold and silver reserves are also drifting toward the hungry and unsatiable hands of the Middle Eastern nations. Is it all a coincidence, a blind fate of destiny, or a stroke of good luck? I remember back in Israel a few years ago when the oil was discovered in the Middle East, and they were getting very rich, and they started sitting on piles of money instead of on chairs. There used to be a story there that Moses, when he led Israel out of Egypt, he came to the land of Israel, and apparently he made the wrong turn. Instead of turning right, he turned left. He should have turned right where all the oil is. Now, just a story, and I'll have to ask Moses about it if he made a mistake when the time comes. Now, did biblical prophecies ignore this crucial end time, mighty weapon of oil? Or did they foresee it as they did the fulfilling of the birthright promises? Why do the countries in the Middle East have such an irrational and deep-rooted bitter hatred toward the Jews, and with a growing measure toward the U.S., and Britain, and I'm sure as time goes on, it's going to be also the nations of Israel in Europe, Iran, for example, and also Libya? Why do they demand the total extinction and dismantling of the state of Israel and the repossession of the land which was promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Israel and their descendants forever? This is the fact that even the Quran, which is the Muslim Bible, states. Why do we have the Palestinian issue, the demand for rights and a homeland? Who are the Palestinians, biblically? Why do we have the PLO terrorism, which is mostly directed against civilians, defenseless civilians, women and children, both in the Middle East and outside of the Middle East? Why do we have constant wars and a perpetual hatred against the Jews in now America or Joseph? Why do we have bloodshed over Jerusalem and a tiny land called by the Jews Israel and by the Arabs Palestine? Why is it that every time when we have a new regime in the Middle East, a fanatic regime especially, we find that one of the first statements that they make is all the Arabs ought to unite against the enemy, the Zionist enemy, so they can destroy Israel and regain the Arab lands? And it seems to be that it never fails. Every new regime in the Middle East makes that statement. The Ayatollah Khomeini just made it a short time ago when he took over in Iran. And of course, they have a lot of hatred not only for the Jews, and they declare economic war not only against the Jews but also against Joseph, and their hatred intensifies against Joseph. I would speak always in biblical terms about Joseph, not just America and Britain, because it is, as I said, a family squabble. What do Joseph's birthright promises have to do with the conflict in the Middle East? And who are anyway the people of the Middle East? We all know them by the modern names, and they had ancient roots. And who are they? What is the motivation behind the, you might say, 4,000, 4 millennia old motivation and struggle that the Arabs have? Why do they declare an economic war against the West, and that includes also Israel? And finally, and yet most importantly, what does the God, not of Ishmael or Esau or Palestine, but the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, has to say about the Middle East conflict, the oil-rich Arab nations, the perpetual hatred against Judah and Israel, the Palestinians and PLO and their demands for rights to the homeland, or to a homeland in the land he gave to Israel and their descendants forever? Now, in this Bible study, I'd like to shed some new lights about this area of the Middle East. I'd like to go through it from the biblical, from the historical, and also from the personal point of view. And I'd like to dig into this 4,000-year-old fascinating story, which perhaps has not and could not have been fully understood until the 73 war, that is the Yom Kippur War, because it was during this time that was a time of a turning point in world scene, world events, and after that the Middle East oil rich nations, that is the Arab nations, have for the first time flexed their mighty muscle of oil weapon against the West, and likewise against anybody who would dare confront them and oppose their wishes. By doing so, they have ushered the world violently into a new era of danger and turmoil and economic chaos and dependence upon the mercy and the whims of the Middle East new economic lords. As I said, I'd like to approach this subject also from the personal point of view, since I came from that part of the country and I cannot divorce myself from that. I'd like to approach it as an Israeli and as a person that was born and reared in the Middle East. Now, this Bible study will take also into account, as I mentioned before, the story of Joseph, that is a fulfillment of the birthright promises to Joseph, mainly, and of course the blessings also to the rest of Israel. It will take into account the identity of Joseph, and without such connection, the Middle East conflict cannot really be fully understood. Now, Mr. McNair gave a series of four excellent Bible studies. I'm sure he didn't have all the time he needed. It's a very long story also. But there was an awful lot of material there, background material. There were two on Joseph, on the birthright, and two on the throne of David. And if you would bring that into mind, and likewise if you would bring into mind the PT article in the 79 issue about the Middle East, all that would help us, at least when we go through the subject, and remember everything that you have heard before about the Middle East, so it would not be lost as you go through the details and all the slides and the scriptures that we go through, because it is really a very clear picture from a biblical point of view and also a historic point of view. Now, before I plunge further into this subject, I'd like for you to consider a few points. The first one, these are critical points. About 200 years ago or less, there was no way to properly and fully understand the birthright promises, for the simple reason they have not been given yet. to Joseph, let alone to uncover the true identity of the U.S. and B.C. peoples. Prophecies concerning Joseph could not have been fully understood until the last generation or the last century, because this is the time when all of them, or at least most of them, are happening, and many more will yet happen. Third point, prophecies can often be understood fully only after they have occurred. An example is the USNBC. If we had a Bible study 500 years ago and we went through the USNBC, I don't think we would have had much information or understanding of who they are, where are they, and what are the prophecies about them. Another point, when Joseph lost its identity, the world also lost the identity and the understanding of the promises and the prophecies concerning Joseph and the rest of the house of Israel. We all know that they intermingled with the Gentiles and they thought of themselves later on as Gentiles also. And so the world does not know them, they don't know who they are. And a certain person that I would speak about had exactly the same fate. Another point, in order to understand the progressively revealed prophecies about the Middle East and also about the world, we ought to allow ourselves to constantly grow in grace, in knowledge and understanding, which can be done only by constant study, watching, and at times reevaluating our current understanding, which is often based on contemporary evidence, revelation, and understanding of world events. And of course the understanding that the past has given to us. And one example to that in recent history was Hitler and Mussolini in World War II. At the time we thought, based on the contemporary understanding that we had, that that was it. And then later on we found out there is more to it because time went on. And so the full picture is really revealed only after everything has happened. And so we can call this study the Middle East conflict through the Word of God, or the lost identity of a brother, and the mysterious 3,400 years old personal war of God, or the God of Israel, against a perpetual enemy, which amounts to the missing dimension in the Middle East. Now I'd like to add, as I said generally in Israel, this is not the law from Sinai. I still have to research a lot into this subject. There are some speculations, some possibilities, as we generally have in a about a prophetic subject and history, and it is more for information basis, so do not take it as a doctrine. Now, would you believe that the conflict in the Middle East began by pulling on someone's leg? Those who are sharp at biblical understanding may be ahead of me. Now let's go first to a story which happened about 2,500 years ago to get on the right track, which would finally lead us to the present day. There you see a map. It is a modern map. I should have put an ancient one, but for those who were not born in the ancient days, you would know that that nation in the middle is Iran, or Iran, as some call it, in this country. In the old times, in ancient days, that was Persia. And in that part of the world, a very interesting story happened. The Book of Esther. I'm sure you all heard about it. Let's all turn to the Book of Esther. That is, if you can, in the dark. Well, now that you've seen the map, there is no need to see it anymore. And I presume the lights can go on so everybody can see. In the Book of Esther, there is a story, which is a very interesting story, about an event, a major event, in the life, in the history of the Jews, an event that happened, as you saw in the map, in the very part that is called today Iran. Is it a coincidence? If you all know the first chapter and the second, it tells the story of the king Ahasuerus. He loved to have big parties that lasted for 6 months. That's a real big one. And for an appetizer after that, he had another party for 7 days. And in that part of the country, the story of Ahasuerus and later on the story of Mordecai and Esther, no relations to me, though I happened to be Mordecai and my oldest sister happened to be Esther also. We were born, both of us, on Purim or around that time. And that's why we have these names. I understand my dad was very good in math. And in that part of the of the country, a very interesting story that is leading to the present Middle East and also to something that happened even before that. And as I said, in the first two chapters, we read about the party, and then after that, the king invited the queen, Vashti, and she would not come, and they decided to depose her. And of course, when the queen went, the king needed another queen, and they were looking for someone new. And so in chapter 2 and verse 5, we read, "Now in Shushan, the palace, there was a certain Jew that was in the lower part of Iran, or Iran, old Persia. There was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Yair, the son of Shimi, the son of Kish. He was a Benjamite, so I'm sure he was not a relative of mine. And in verse 7, and he brought up Hadassah, which is Esther, his uncle's daughter. And she was very beautiful, and of course, as we know the story, she was chosen as the next queen. And that leads to chapter 3 and verse 1. Once she was the queen, Mordecai was promoted. He was able to sit at the king's palace or the court and the gate. I don't know what office he had, but he was among the dignitaries there, and apparently was sitting there in a certain official capacity. And so we read in chapter 3, "After these things did Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedata, the Agagite." Remember this name, the Agagite. "And advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence." One of those rebellious Jews, I guess. In verse 3, "Then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said unto Mordecai, Why do you transgress the king's commandment? Now it came to pass, when they spoke daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman, to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand. For he had told them that he was a Jew." In other words, they wanted to know what Haman would do about it. And in verse 5, "And when Haman saw Mordecai, he saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath." And verse 6, "And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone." In other words, Mordecai was not enough for him. "For they had showed him the people of Mordecai, wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai." Now remember, the empire at that time was about 120 nations. I presume it was most of the civilized world beside China and other parts there, but it was a giant empire, and the Jews were scattered in all those places. And one Jew in the capital transgressed against Haman, and he wanted to destroy all the Jews. You wonder why. And then verse 11, "He went to the king and he made a deal with him." And it says in verse 10, "And the king took his ring from his hand and gave it unto Haman, the son of Hammedata the Agagite." Now repeating this name, Agagite, it is a very important one. The Jews' enemy. And so Haman had the permission from the king to destroy all the Jews. And in verse 13, "And the letters were sent by posts into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day." In verse 6,
on chapter 6, rather, we read about, in verse 13, about the end of it, or at least when things started going bad, and if you know the book and what went in between, things were not going very well for Haman after that, and they were changing. And so in verse 13, and Haman told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends, everything that had befallen him. That's when things started going wrong for him. Then said his wise man, and Zeresh, his wife, unto him, if Mordecai be the seed of the Jews, before whom you have begun to fall, you shall not prevail against him, but shall surely fall before him. She was a beautiful wife, and what an encouragement she gave him. Now, why did she say that? Of course, there's some background behind it. And as we get to Exodus 17 and Deuteronomy 25, we'll find more about it. Why did she make that statement to Haman? Now, one point to remember, that if Haman was successful, and if he killed all the Jews, there would have been no savior. Which means that somebody wanted the destruction, somebody that was not necessarily a man. Now the story ends with the total decimation of Haman and his family. As you can read later on in the story, the vengeance has been fully executed by Mordecai and Esther, which I may call the avengers of God. And that was the end of Haman. Now let's go back to chapter 3 and verse 1 and ask the question. There we read that Haman was an Agagite. Now let's ask the question, why did he have the desire to destroy all the Jews, not just Mordecai? It's against him. Why not just eliminate Mordecai and solve the problem? Why does he want to kill an entire race because of one person? It sounds very, very irrational. A very irrational hatred. Now, in this age, somebody in that very part of the country called Iran wants to do just the same if he could. And guess who? Presently he has 50 Israelites in his possession. So let's find out the background of this Agagite in order to find out why did he want to do it, what was the source of his irrational hatred, and let's find out who are the Agagites that lived before him, after him, and until this very day. And this will be only one link in the chain of the panorama of the Middle East. Let's go to the blessings of Abraham, because this is where the story begins, and that is in Genesis. In Genesis chapter 16, we know that Abraham, and I'm not going to cover a lot of background because you already have it, as I said, the birthright promises, and the series of Mr. McNair and many other studies we had before have given us a lot of material. And so we know that Abraham, who wanted to give the blessings to Ishmael, was not allowed or permitted to do so, but he was supposed to give it to Isaac. And so we read in chapter 16 and in verse 10. It says, and the angel of the Lord said unto her, that is to Hagar, when she ran away from Sarah, I will multiply your seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude. Now this is the blessing to Ishmael. Verse 11, and the angel of the Lord said unto her, behold, you are with a child. Sounds like Luke 1, where the angel, or the archangel Gabriel, told Mary about the birth of Jesus. So the birth of Ishmael has been predicted even before it happened. And it says, you are with a child, and you shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, because the Eternal has heard your voice, or your affliction. And in verse 12, and he will be a wild man. His hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. Now this scripture is very critical to today's Middle East scene. The fact that Ishmael was going to dwell in the presence of all his brethren. Now, who are the brethren of Ishmael? Well, we know that Hagar was the wife of Abraham, but also Sarah was the wife of Abraham, and likewise Keturah later on.
We know that from Sarah came Isaac, and from Isaac, Jacob and Esau. From Esau came 14 dukes that we can read in chapter 36. We'll come to that later. From Isaac, or rather from Jacob, 13 tribes. All of these later on became nations, or at least small nations, some of them. Keturah had 6 sons that probably became 6 nations, or at least large tribes that live in the Middle East. These are the brethren of Ishmael. And if you remember also, Ishmael had a nephew, his name was Lot, and he had 2 sons, Ammon and Moab, and they all live in the Middle East, and they're all brethren. It's a family affair, as I said. And so Ishmael was to live in the presence of all his brethren. In chapter 17 and verse 4, we read about Abraham being a father of many nations. If you count all these nations up to now, you already have about 45. And we know the British people of Ephraim are more than just one, so you have at least about 50 nations there. That's plenty from one man. In verse 20 of chapter 17, the blessing has been repeated to Ishmael, and it says here, "As for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him and will make him fruitful and will multiply him exceedingly. 12 princes shall he beget, and I will make him a great nation." Just like you have in the United States, it is a great nation, but you have about 50 states. And so there are many governors, many princes in this land. And Ishmael was going to have many nations that would come out of him. In chapter 21, the story continues. In chapter 21 and verse 17, at that time, Abraham was told, commanded actually by God, to send away Hagar and Ishmael her son. And she went to the desert, and we know the story that she couldn't find water, and her son was going to die, and so she cried unto God. And in verse 17 we read, "And God heard the voice of the lad. And the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven, and said unto her, What ails you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. And verse 18, Arise, lift up the lad, and hold him in your hand. For I, that is God, will make him a great nation." And in verse 20, "And God was with the lad." Notice the special relationship that God has with Ishmael. "And he grew and dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer. And he dwelt in the wilderness of Paran." Now the wilderness of Paran, I have to use the gun for that, is in that direction. This is the wilderness of Paran. Notice the relationship. This is the Negev Desert. This is the land of Israel, or Canaan at the time. This is Edom, and Paran is right here. That is the Sinai Peninsula. So, in the Sinai Peninsula, which is called today the Sinai Peninsula, Ishmael began his habitation at that time. And that place, as I said, was next to his brethren, because he began his dwelling in the presence of all his brethren. Edom on one side, that is from Esau, and Moab, and Ammon, and of course on top, the tribes of Israel. And he was in the wilderness of Paran, verse 21, "And his mother took him a wife out of the land of Egypt." Now Hagar, remember, she was an Egyptian woman. She took Ishmael, who was half Egyptian, another Egyptian woman, which means that the children of Ishmael were three-quarters Egyptian. Now, notice that in the blessings to Ishmael, there is no blessing of fatness of the earth, or the dew of heaven, or riches. And that is very significant to the present Middle East conflict or sin. Also, he was to dwell in the presence of all his brethren. That is the children of Keturah, I said, and the children of Esau, and the children of Israel, and also the children of Hagar, his mother, as we read in Psalm 83 and verse 6, the Hagarines. Probably his mother remarried, she was still a young woman. and he must have had more half-brothers from her, and so he was to dwell in their presence, and likewise in the presence of the nephew of his father, Abraham, Lot, that is Ammon and Moab. Now in the end time, we know that Israel, or actually in the past 2700 years, the 10 tribes did not live in the presence of Ishmael, but we know that many of the Jews did, and until recently, even in the Middle East itself, that is apart from Israel, there were many hundreds of thousands of Jews, about 600,000, that lived in the presence of all the tribes of the Middle East. And we know also that the British people and the Americans and the people of Israel, that is from Northwestern Europe, lived in the Middle East also. There were hundreds of thousands of them in Egypt and Jordan and Syria and North Africa and many other parts of the Middle East. Other points to remember, Ishmael, he was a son of a bondwoman, which means she was not a wife in the same way that Sarah was. She did not have the same rights. He had no recorded complaints about the birthright that was given to Isaac. There is no recorded hatred or animosity against Isaac. He married an Egyptian woman, which means that his children were three-quarters Egyptian. And a very important point, God was with him. As we read, he gave him his name even before he was born. He blessed him to become exceedingly great in multitudes, and he heard his voice. And Ishmael knew it. And therefore, he did not defy God's will in giving the birthright to Isaac instead of to him, though he was the firstborn. These points are very critical to the present Middle East. Now the blessings we know were given to Isaac, and from Isaac they were given to his children. That is Jacob. Esau received some blessings also. Let's read in, let's go to chapter 25. In chapter 25 and verse 23. We know when Rebecca went to, I suppose I did not press the button at the right time, so I'll appreciate having the lights on. If you can't read it anyway, I'll go through it. In verse 23, we read what God told Rebecca. It says, "And the Lord said unto her, Two nations are in your womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from your bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger." And later on, we read about the birth of Esau, the firstborn. He was a hairy man. That's why he was called Esau. Esau in Hebrew means grass. He was a grassy man. He had grass all over his body. And he was also red. That's why he was called Edom. He was the first red, maybe the first redneck, I guess, in the Middle East. And after that, Jacob was born. And later on we read in verse 30, or before that, in verses 25 to 27, you know the story about the selling of the birthright. Jacob bought it from Esau in a very shrewd way, as Jacob had shown even later on. That was one of the problems of Jacob, and of course Esau didn't like that. But nevertheless, Esau sold his birthright in verses 32 and 34. We read about that, about the selling of the birthright to Jacob. Now here you might consider the fact that, as we read in the Bible many times before, Abraham obeyed God. He obeyed his voice, he obeyed his commandments, he obeyed his laws, and even taught his son, and he taught his children. And if you consider that Abraham had about 318 men that he could take to war, and he had many, many servants, and he taught them, that probably means that he had Bible studies and Sabbath services. There has to be one day to teach them. And I'm sure, according to some speculations, he had about 3,000 servants. And that is about two auditoriums filled every Sabbath. They had no other place to go, so I'm sure they all came. And he taught them. And so in a sense you might say there was a church there. And lots of members that came to the church. And Isaac was born in that church. And he came to services also. And when he grew up, he also taught his children. And they were all very, very rich. And they had nice places to meet. They had an auditorium also. I presume they found some archaeological digs in the area that may indicate the possibility of that. Now Esau decided as he grew up, probably he was a teenager, that hunting was more fun than attending services, and so he became what you might call a church dropout. And that probably led him to this attitude of despising the birthright. And of course we read in the book of Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 16 that he was a profane man. And I better go very, very fast because I have a very short time, about 3 hours left only, that is of material. And so he sold his birthright. At the time he didn't think too much about it. And then we read about the blessings. Now this was the birthright, and after that come the blessings. And the blessings in chapter 28, actually in chapter 27, this is the I thought I probably have only one or two slides and after that the light will come on, but nothing works. In chapter 27, we read about the blessings that were given to Jacob. And we all know them, I hope, by heart, so I don't have to read it. It says that God will give him the fatness of the earth and the dew of heaven. And he was going to make him lord over his sons. That is his mother's sons and over his brethren. And we understand all these prophecies and birthright promises that later on were passed to Joseph. And then, of course, we know that the way Jacob did it is by a sort of a swindling of the birthright. In other words, Isaac was supposed to receive it, and you know the story how Jacob got into the act with the help of his mother, and he got the blessings. And Esau came later on and he found out about it. And he was very, very hurt. He was very upset. He didn't like it. And he said in verse 36, and he said, "Is not he rightly named Jacob?" That is the supplanter. "For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing." And he asked his father if he didn't have any other blessing left for him. And if you remember, he's talking about the birthright and then a blessing. That means that in the blessing, God was going to confer through Isaac the birthright to the firstborn. And of course, the blessing was not the birthright, but the blessing was going to contain the birthright, and the blessing was also for the rest of the children of Israel, as we see in chapter 49, where Jacob gave the blessing, or the blessings, to all of Israel, and the birthright only to Joseph. And so we read in verse 39 the blessing that he gave to Isaac, that is, Isaac gave to Esau. It says, "And Isaac said," that is, Isaac his father, "answered and said unto him, Behold, your dwelling shall be the fatness of the earth and of the dew of heaven from above, and by your sword shall you live, and you shall serve your brother, and it shall come to pass, when you shall have the dominion, that you shall break his yoke from off your neck." Now notice the words, I'll come back to that later. And Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing, that is the blessing that he lost. And at the end of the sentence it says that the days of mourning for my father are at hand, then will I slay my brother Jacob. And so we read about the hatred of Esau toward Jacob because of the fact that he has supplanted him twice. And the critical points to remember here, the first one, that Jacob was going to be the lord over his brethren, And the sons of his mother also, in that case will be Esau and his sons, will serve the recipients of the birthright holder and the blessings. And the second point, it was God who was going to give him the blessings, which were the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth. And later on, of course, and even before that in other places, we read about the expansion of the blessings that were passed on to Joseph. Now, Esau, as we read in those scriptures, didn't like it at all. And his reaction was very natural. You can put yourself in his shoes. His father was very, very rich. He was going to give him promises and blessings and a birthright. And Jacob got it all. And Esau, being what he was, a hunter and highly emotional person also, I presume, decided that he is going to kill his brother. And he thought by that maybe he can get the blessings from him. And this hatred is a very elementary key, an important key to the present Middle East conflict. And I will come back to that later. Now, of course, there are four reasons for the hatred of Esau. He lost the greatest physical birthright and promises. And if you remember the series of Mr. McNair, you would remember how much he lost, an awful lot. On top of that, he was going to serve his younger brother, which was a great humiliation for an older son to do. He lost also the blessing that came at the end, through which he hoped to regain the birthright, and of course he lost the scepter through it. I'm sure that Esau knew a lot about these promises and what they really meant, though, as we read before, he despised them at a certain point. And so the major points to remember in this case, that the blessings in chapter 27, verses 28 and 29 to Jacob, as well as we read them to other places, were to be finally given to Joseph and to be fulfilled in fullness in the last days, that is, in our days, in the past two centuries, and especially in the last century, or maybe even less. The second one, that is a very significant to the fulfillment of prophecy, verses 39 and 41 are attached to the blessing to Jacob, because Jacob was going to pass it on to Joseph, and Joseph was going to be the one in the actual fulfillment of the prophecy that is was going to be the Lord over his brethren. And therefore, if the brethren would be Joseph, that is Esau, naturally when the promises will be fulfilled to Jacob, and Jacob, as we call him today, Joseph, at that time also the promises that are attached to Jacob, the promises that were given to Esau, they too will be fulfilled. Now the third point to remember, that the world and the church did not fully understand the identity of Joseph and the prophecies and the promises and the blessings which were connected with the birthright owner Joseph until the last days, that is, the past two centuries. And so with these three points, let's go on with the subject and remember them, for they are very elementary and very critical to the present Middle East situation. Now, in chapter 27 and verse 41, we read about the hatred, that is, the spirit of murder, that entered into the heart of Esau, and he was going to murder his brother Jacob, as he said. It was the beginning of Esau's deeply rooted hatred and spirit of murder, with a perpetual desire to kill and to murder Jacob. Now remember that Ishmael never had such hatred toward Isaac. At least it is not recorded. And even as you go through the entirety of the whole Bible, that is the Old Testament, you just don't see statements telling us about the hatred of Ishmael against his, in that case, his nephew, Jacob. But to Ishmael it was a very great loss. It was too humiliating, and it was not to ever be forgotten. Now if you remember, the first slide that I had here was of a desert, the land of Edom. And the land of Edom was not the most beautiful land. It was a cruel land. It was a land that was dry. And you can imagine, generation after generation, the children of Esau would pass the stories about Uncle Esau, the deceitful uncle Esau, taking the birthright from their father, the deceitful uncle Jacob, taking all the promises and the birthright from their father Esau. And in those days, you had the campfire, and you were telling stories, and you can imagine, generation after generation, the intensity of the hatred that was passed on to the children of Esau. And that spirit of revenge is still raging until this very day in his descendants. Now, to fully understand the full scope of such deep hatred and perpetual irrational animosity of the children of Esau, to understand that hatred, you have to look at the birthright promises. You have to look at the time of the entering into the land of milk and honey, a very beautiful land. Esau saw it, but Esau couldn't get it. And naturally, Esau was getting mad. And every generation, he was getting even madder. And his bitterness and hatred was growing in leaps and bounds as he saw the beautiful land that Jacob had, and he did not have, because Jacob was a supplanter. Now, to understand how does the son of Esau feel today about the loss of the birthright is to understand the highly emotional Middle Eastern peoples and their great capacity for hatred toward Judah and also toward Israel. So let's remember the important points and differences again about Ishmael, that is Uncle Ishmael and Uncle Esau. They're not the same. Ishmael was the son of a bondwoman. He was sent away. He lost the birthright, but then he did not contest that. There is no recorded hatred against Isaac. And we know that Isaac was not involved with that. There was no swindling on his part. And God was with Ishmael. He gave him the blessings of the multitudes. He was to dwell in the presence of all of his brethren, that is Ishmael. In contrast to that, Esau was the son of the same mother, of Jacob. He was the firstborn. He was swindled of the blessing and the birthright by a deceitful Jacob. That was from his point of view. He was not given any greatness in number, that is a blessing of multitudes, and God was not with him. And to gain his blessing, he was going to live by the sword, and to gain his blessings also by the sword. In Malachi chapter 1, in verses 2 and 3, you remember where Jacob talks to God, sort of argument there back and forth, and God says, Jacob I loved and Esau I hated. And that's probably the reason, that is the character. We're talking about the sin of the man, not the man himself. We have to separate between both. He was hating the defiance of Esau. He was hating the state of mind, not necessarily the man himself. In Genesis 36, the land of Edom and the genealogy of Edom spoken about, it was a barren, rocky country, not the most beautiful one. And Esau lived in that area. We read about the genealogy of Esau. He married two Canaanite women first, and after that he married a daughter of Ishmael, which gave the descendants of Esau two more claims to the land of Israel. That is, two of their mothers are Canaanites, and the Canaanites possessed the land at the time, so they thought they had the rights. And likewise, one of their mothers was the daughter of Ishmael, which means it gave them another right, because Ishmael should have got the birthright and not Isaac. And then the son of Esau, the firstborn of Esau, was Eliphaz. And Eliphaz had different sons. The first one was Teman, which is very interesting. One of the cities or the capitals of Edom was called Teman. And likewise, in the map that I missed now, because I had to go through this section to try to get the lights on, which never came on, the land of Teman was at the bottom. Okay. The land of Edom was a barren and rocky place, as I said, and the children of Esau were not too happy. Anyway, they propagated in that place, and they started spreading in all directions because they lived by the sword. And the firstborn was Teman. As I said, there was a land down today is called Yemen. The biblical name and the Hebrew name for that land is Teman. And I was wondering if there is any connection between the two. The firstborn of Teman. Another of his sons was Omar. And if you remember, I said before, the mosque that is in Jerusalem called the Dome of the Rock. In the Middle East, it is called the Mosque of Omar. That is the real name of it. And again, I wonder if there is any connection in that direction. Now, another grandson of Esau was called Amalek. He was born from Timnah, the daughter of Seir. And Amalek has an awful lot to do with the present Middle East conflict. And as we can see a little bit later on. I haven't got much time here, and I understand I can go about 5 minutes after nine. And later on, I didn't realize I'll have so much material and I'll be going so slow. When you have so much about the Middle East, it's quite a problem. You just cannot finish it. But as much as I can, I'll be able to give you this occasion. Now, Esau had 14 dukes, as I said before. Seven of them, or actually 10 of them, were from Canaanite women. That is, there was a Canaanite blood in them. Four of them came from the daughter of Ishmael. So there was an Ishmaelite blood in them. And there we see a mixture. And the names, when you read in Genesis 36, the names are reminding us of, if you know in the Middle East, different names that are very common. For example, the name Hadad, that was one of the dukes of Edom, is a very common name in Iraq, in Syria, in even in Iran, that is in the Arab part of Iran, in Turkey, and among the Kurdish people. And so I'd like to concentrate a little bit more now on Amalek. Now, the children of Israel were supposed to go from Egypt as they were coming out of Israel. If they took the right direction to Israel, they would have gone, as you see there, the arrows along the coast. But instead of that, they went down because God decided if they will go up, they might have war there. You see Amalek right there, and he did not want them to have any war. Now, Amalek being the firstborn of Esau from, that is the second firstborn actually, from Eliphaz, the firstborn of Esau, somehow seemed to have become the favorite firstborn of Esau. And so in many scriptures we can see that he became in one way the chief contender for the birthright. In other words, he thought that the land really belongs to him, and so he moved into the land, and that's where he ended, along the coast, along the Philistines. And when the children of Israel came, as I said, they went down instead of up. They went down to Rephidim, and as they went down to Rephidim, the scripture tells us in Exodus chapter 17, verses 8 and 10, it says, then came Amalek. That is, Amalek came down to fight with Israel. And it's a very interesting fight that we have there. And I'd like to go through that. In Exodus chapter 17, it's not 14, chapter 17, in verse 8, it says, then came Amalek and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And the story goes about Moses taking the rod of God, going up the mountain, telling Joshua, you go fight. And he was to lift his hands, and it says there, very strange way to fight a war. When he lifted up his hands, Israel would win the battle, and when he dropped his hands, Amalek would win the battle. Gives you the idea of today, as Mr. Armstrong lifting up his hands. That means lifting the rod. That means looking up to God, and likewise as we do, we win the battle. And as his hands drop because we do not support him, as Moses asked for his hands to be supported, it seems to be that we are losing the battle. I thought it was a good analogy there. And finally, from the story, we know that the Amalekites were defeated, and Joshua won the war. And in verse 14, a very interesting scripture, 14 and 15, actually also 16, it says, and the Lord said unto Moses, write this for a memorial in a book, and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And then it says that Moses erected an altar there, and he called it God, called the altar God My Miracle, or God Nisi. And verse 16, for he said, because the Eternal has sworn, it's not the correct translation, in the margins we see, because the hand of Amalek is against the throne of the Lord. In other words, Amalek, being the firstborn from Esau, thinking that the birthright belongs to him and Jacob has no business coming up and claiming it when he was ready to take over as soon as he could, he came down and he was going to fight Israel and defeat them, and he thought maybe he can even destroy them. And in one sense he was fighting without realizing God himself, because it was the will of God to give it to Jacob and not to Esau, or to Amalek, the firstborn of Esau. And so it says God has sworn by his throne that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation, and that is until this very day, as long as generations go on. And so Amalek continues with his fight, and there are a lot of scriptures that cover this point. He naturally did not consider what we read in the book of Daniel chapter 4 and verse 17, that the land is given to the children of man according to the will of God and not according to the will of man. And so Israel continued up toward the land, and they wanted to go through the land of Edom. And in chapter 20 of Numbers, you can just write that down, I don't have time to go through it, we read that Edom would not let them go. As a matter of fact, he said, if you come through the land, I will come out with a sword and I will destroy you, or at least fight with you. And so they had to go around it, and they were getting closer to the land of Moab. As they came to the land of Moab, which is right above Edom, you can see it in that. This is Edom. Israel had to go around, and this is Moab. As they were close to Moab, you know the story of Balak and Balaam and the curse that they wanted to pronounce on the children of Israel. And of course, instead of that, Balaam blessed them, and even said in that place, there are a lot of scriptures that describe what went on, a few chapters. In one of them, Balaam was saying that the kingdom of Jacob is going to be higher than Agag. And if you remember Haman the Agagite, that's where he goes to. In other words, the Agagite kings were called, the Amalekite kings were called Agag, sort of a pharaoh. And it was a royal line, and Haman was one of the descendants of that royal line. And so they went to that area, and Balaam, instead of cursing Israel, he was blessing Israel, and did not really fulfill the wishes of the king of Moab. And later on he even said that there shall rise a star out of Jacob, and he shall smite the corners of Moab, and Edom shall be a possession unto the children of Israel. In the book of Samuel, the first book of Samuel, chapter 15, you don't have to turn there, the prophet Samuel comes to Saul and he tells him that God, actually before that, a more important one, in Deuteronomy 25, you can just write that down, verses 17-19, before entering into the land, Moses reminds the people about Amalek, and he told them to remember Amalek, that when they enter into the land, the first thing they should do, or at least one of the things they should do, is destroy Amalek and put their remembrance, or blot out their remembrance or their memory. And the reason was because when Israel was coming out of Egypt, Amalek went behind them and he was trying to get all the women, the civilians, not the men of war, which was a characteristic of a certain group today in the Middle East. And that's the way they were fighting at the time also. Now in the book of Samuel, the prophet is telling Saul to do exactly that. He told him to go and kill all the Amalekites, to blot them out from the face of the earth. And we know the story, that Saul did not necessarily do all that. He did most of it, but he did not kill all the Amalekites, because we keep seeing them all the time. As a matter of fact, we see them in prophecy of future times, even this very day, when they are still around. But their king, Agag, again another Agag, was brought to Samuel, and Samuel himself killed the king. David himself, many times here and there, had to fight the Amalekites. The Amalekites, remember, the Amalekites are not just Amalekites, but they are also Edomites. So Edomites and Amalekites are synonymous in one sense. And throughout the history of King David, we see him fighting against the Edomites, subduing them, and partially fulfilling the prophecy that the younger shall rule over the older, that is Jacob over Esau. And we read about an account of Doeg the Edomite, which saw David running away from Saul and coming to the city of the priests and receiving the sword of Goliath. And at that time, he probably knew that he was running away from David, or maybe he did not know, but later on he found out that's what he did, and Saul thought that his men were conspiring against him or are siding with David instead of with him. And Edomite told him that the priests gave David refuge in the city. They gave him bread. They gave him the sword of Goliath. And so Saul was very upset. He told his men to kill the priests, and the men of Saul would not do it. And so Doeg the Edomite was told to do it, and he was very happy to do it because he was an Edomite. And remember, because of the perpetual hatred that there was between Edom and Jacob, and that was multiplying all the time. And he killed all the priests. And then he went to their city, and he killed every single person there. Men, women, and child. And that was in contrast to what the Israelites were told in Deuteronomy by God, not to abhor an Edomite, but to remember that he is a brother. And David continually fought with the Edomites, with the Amalekites. And later on in 1 Kings, there is an account there of something that happened in the past. That is when God stirred an Edomite against an Edomite that happened to be also by the name of Hadad. As I said before, it is a common name in Iraq, Syria, Turkey, and the Kurds. And that man that was from the royal seed of the Edomites was rising against Solomon. And it explains there in the scriptures, one of the reasons why he did not like Solomon is because Joab, the general of David, went to that area of the world, that is area of the country Edom, which is on the right side, and he killed all the Edomites, it says in that section. And he stayed there for 6 months. Apparently it took him 6 months to kill all the Edomites. And the only ones that escaped, it says in that place, are I think about 400 or 200 people. But he killed every man, woman, and child of the Edomites. And of course the Edomites do not grow in love because of this kind of back and forth fighting and hatred. But their hatred becomes more and more cruel. And the perpetual animosity between Edom and Amalek, that is Edom and Amalek, which are the same, and Judah, and even Israel, have been growing constantly. And throughout all this time, you will find out that the Israelites do not have the fights or the animosity or the hatred with Ishmael, but they have it with Edom. There are so many scriptures that talk about it. They are very plain. They are telling the story. And so I would just quote some of them, since I wouldn't have time to go through it. In chapter 137, that is Psalm 137, Judah says, after the captivity, remember the day of Jerusalem. Remember the children of Edom in the day of Jerusalem, when they said, raise it down even to the foundation. That means destroy it completely, because they just hated the Jews, because they lived in the south and they were sort of persecuted by the Jews, you might say. There were the conflicts back and forth. They are still going on till this very day. And when Judah was conquered and lost the battle, that is, was exiled, they wanted a complete destruction of the land. And that's what they were saying, and they were shouting with joy. In Psalm 83, we read the same about the Edomites, about the Amalekites. There, even the Ishmaelites are mentioned, and that's the only place in the Bible where Ishmael is mentioned in a belligerent state against Israel. And they are all in a confederacy. As I said, there were many alliances. And their confederacies are in the markets, and they are also in the halls of the governments. And their subject and their aim is always the same. It is the destruction of Israel. And in Psalm there is a very interesting scripture that says, "Let us, or come, let us destroy them from being a nation, that the name of Israel be remembered no more." And of course the name that they want that land to have is Palestine. And this is what they called it later. In Isaiah 34, speaks about a future war that God will have, a future war of vengeance, where God says that his sword is going to be bathed in blood, the blood of Edom. And he's going to destroy them and obliterate them, at least during this time, that is at his second coming. And if you remember, in the Middle East, there is what we call the jihad. That's what they call the jihad, the holy war. And the concept of the holy war, that when you draw your sword, you don't bring it back until it is filled with blood. And that's exactly what Jesus Christ says in those scriptures. That he was the one that declared the first holy war, as we read in Exodus, against Amalek, and later on against Edom. He was going to have the last battle, the last holy war against Edom. In Isaiah 63, he's repeating exactly the same. And in Jeremiah 49, and in all those places, they always talk about Edom. And they always talk about the fact that God is going to have a war with them. He's going to destroy them. He's going to have a sort of a holy war from generation to generation. Now Edom lived by the sword, and Edom spread to many nations of the Middle East, because you remember Ishmael was going to be in the presence of all his brethren, and Edom happened to be one of them. And Edom likewise, having one of his wives, an Ishmaelite, was mixed with the children of Ishmael. First, you remember Amalek and Edom and Ishmael were in the same area. And so I'm sure they had a lot of intermarriages back and forth, and they are spread all over the Middle East. They are not just in one place. Now, I would skip a lot of scriptures that speak very plainly about it. Read the book of Obadiah. It speaks about Edom, about the violence that they have committed against their brother Jacob. And that includes all the nations of the Middle East. You see the Middle East in the center. On top, you see Turkey. Armenian, and a minority is Turks from Central Asia. But there are Arabs there. It's only a part of it, part of Esau. And of course, they spread throughout the whole Middle East. And many passages that speak about the interaction in conflicts and wars back and forth, and the hatred of Edom against Jacob. Scriptures that, if you read them and you think about the Middle East today and about the statements that were made about the Middle East today, they describe exactly the attitudes of the Arabs today, of the Palestinians, of the different regimes that we find in the Middle East, of the constant war back and forth. In Jeremiah 49, it speaks about Edom in a specific terms, and of course there are other scriptures that talk about it. I have many articles to read, but I wouldn't have time to go through them. In Obadiah, as I said, a very interesting scripture. I'll turn only to one scripture in the book of Joel. And in the book of Joel, it speaks about an end time. The whole chapter, chapter 3 of Joel, speaks about the end times, as it says, "Behold, in those days and in that time when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Israel," or Jerusalem. And the whole chapter speaks about this generation, when Jesus Christ will come back, bring all the people,
And then it says in verse 5, because you have taken my silver and my gold, speaking about the Arabs, or about the people of that area, and we know later on that all that gold and silver will be brought back to Jerusalem. And we know that this is a reality today. The gold and silver of the West, of the United States, of the British Commonwealth, and the northwestern tribes of Israel is flowing into the Middle East. And then he zeroes in on, in verse 19, he says, Egypt shall be a desolation, and Edom shall be desolate wilderness, for the violence against the children of Judah. This scripture is repeated quite a few times in the Old Testament, and I would not have time to go through all of them. But he says, it's going to be a wilderness for the violence against the children of Judah, because they have shed innocent blood in their land. He's talking about Edomites. And if I had more time to go through all the accounts of the Edomites, constantly Edomites, Edomites here and Edomites there, and of course Amalekites with them, which were also Edomites, constantly shedding blood, innocent blood as God calls it, against their brethren, Judah. And as it says here, in their land, this is where they generally, you know, the PLO and the nations of the Arabs, whenever they have wars, at least along the borders, and the PLO inside through terrorist attacks and bombings and everything else, they shed innocent blood in their land, that is the land of Judah. And as I said, this whole chapter is a modern prophetic chapter for this generation. It does not speak about times past, and many other accounts do speak about times that happened in the past and likewise about today. Now, if you remember Ishmael, all the points about Ishmael did not have any animosity or hatred toward Isaac. It is not recorded. We don't see much of it, but we constantly see Jacob and Edom fighting against each other because of the fact that the birthright was lost to Esau, and Esau of the two, that is, of Ishmael and Esau. Esau was the only one that defied the will of God. And the firstborn of Esau, Amalek, from Eliphaz, was the one that decided that he is going to have the land and he was going to fight against Israel in the desert, as you saw the map before. And the violence continued from generation to generation. This is an area where the Arabs took over. We call it the West Bank, the area where Manasseh and Ephraim lived in the past. But Arabs claim this is their land, occupied land. The Ayatollah Ringo, that happened to be a son of the chief Ayatollah of the Revolutionary Council in Iran. His aim is the destruction of Israel. There is an article here, I don't have the time to read it, but he said that the Ayatollah told him, as he told the people, today Iran, tomorrow Palestine, and so based on that he decided he's going to go ahead and recruit many soldiers from Iran and other places and train them, which he still does to this very day. As a matter of fact, that's what he's doing now. He's training them, the Palestinians, the PLO, are training them in Iraq and mainly in Syria and also in Lebanon, so they can go and fight Israel and regain the land and give it back to the Palestinians. There you see guerrillas, PLO guerrillas, are only about 16, 17, and they are claiming that all the Arab nations are just paying lip service. I had a very scripture here in Obadiah that speaks about that, about the confederacy that the Palestinians have, that is a confederacy with other nations, but all they do is just paying them lip service. They are not really fighting as they promised to do. And this young teenager that is fighting in the PLO, or actually training for it, claims that our real enemy, or at least number one enemy, should be not Israel. That too is number one. But the number one and the first one should come first, and that is the Arabs themselves. Because all they do is pay lip service to the Palestinians, but they would not really fight for them. And as you remember, Esau is spread all over the Middle East. There are elements of it everywhere. It is Ishmael that is great in multitude. Esau is not. But they are all mixed and they are all over. And from time to time you would hear the Palestinians here and there
speaking about the destruction of Israel, but it's more a lot of talk. Now the blessings to Esau, I'll have to take a couple more minutes here and finish. In chapter 27 and verses 38 and 41, speak about the fatness of the earth and about the dew of heaven. Exact wordings as the blessing to Jacob. Now, I'll have to skip some of the slides to come to that. Those maps. As you go through, notice the violence against Jacob. And that is against Judah also. But we have a map there, for example, of Yemen at the bottom, which is called Teman. And that's one of the dukes of Esau. And then we have the oil. If you can see the oil all around, it is mainly concentrated not in Saudi Arabia peninsula, not here, but toward the coast, that is the Gulf of the Persian Gulf states. And the Iranian oil is concentrated in this area. And it's very interesting that all the oil of Iran is in this area, and the majority of the people there are Arabs, not Persians. They're all Arabs. And Iraq is on the other side of it. And the word fatness of the earth, it's a very simple word in Hebrew, and generally has a major meaning and one only meaning. Of course, it may mean different things depending on how you use it. But the oil, the fatness of the earth, as Isaac told Esau, he says, "Oh, the fatness of the earth be your dwelling," is oil. Now, is there a connection between the fatness of the earth, the fact that he was going to have the fatness of the earth, and the blessing of oil? I think it's very interesting seeing the Middle Eastern, especially elements. Now, it's not generally all the people that are fighting the Middle East. It's oftentimes just small elements in every nation. All the Middle East that are hating the Jews or hating the West, and all the rest just go along with them, as you see in Iran. And so if there is a connection there, then probably Esau is all over being mixed with Ishmael. And if the blessing, the fatness of the earth, means oil, is it possible that oil and the blessing that was given to Esau are the same? In that case, is it possible that Esau is all over the Middle East? And since the blessing of oil, that is fatness of the earth and rain, was given to him and not to Ishmael, could it be that the oil of the Middle East is actually given to the children of Esau? Now, when you have all that in mind, and as I said, I don't have the time, I'm already about 10 minutes over time, I should stop right here. But take all that into an account. There are so many details to cover. But if you can just remember the scriptures in Obadiah, in the book of Joel, all the chapters before that, and of course go back to the history of Esau and the history of Jacob, look in the concordance, Edom, Esau, Amalek. If you read all of them, you'll see one whole picture. Esau is fighting Jacob. Jacob and Esau were given the fatness of the land. In time past, it was not understood, as the prophecies toward Joseph was not understood, but as they were fulfilled, we understand them more. Now, is it possible that the fatness of the earth that was given to Esau is actually oil? And the dew of heaven. Many of the parts of the Middle East, like the Fertile Crescent of Iraq and Syria and Lebanon, is a very, very fertile place. It could be the dew of heaven. And if the other one is the oil, the fatness of the earth, and this one is the dew of heaven, is a blessing to Esau, actually a real blessing. And therefore we see oil mixed as a weapon in the fight of Esau against Jacob. Now we put all that together, we look at the slides, we look at the prophetic events, we read all the scriptures that speak generally only about Esau fighting, that is Edom, or Esau or Amalek fighting Jacob, and I don't know if we can draw a conclusion. I said this is not a doctrine. If I had more time, probably it would have been much more clearer in our minds.
But is it possible that the fight that we find in the Middle East and the roots are not the roots of Ishmael, Judah war, that is a Jew-Arab war in the strict sense, but an Esau, Jacob war? Is it possible that the oil that is given to the children of Esau, if the connection is right, is a fulfilled prophecy, as the oil and the fatness of the land were given also to the children of Joseph? If it is possible, if it is right, if it is correct, if all the scriptures that are there and they are very clear and they speak about the time when God, when he comes, will destroy Edom, and I have to wonder why so many scriptures in the Bible that talk about an utter destruction and obliteration of Edom, and at the same time about oil all over the Middle East and about constant war and hatred of Esau against Jacob. Is it possible that the prophecies and the blessings that were given at that time by Isaac to Jacob and Esau are the real roots and the causes of the present Middle East conflict? I don't know if it is. I have the inclination to believe that it is. It is very, very close to that. I don't know all the nations that are involved. Where is Esau exactly? Everywhere. I know they are spread throughout the Middle East. I know that this is the possibility of fatness, because Ishmael did not receive any blessing of fatness or the dew of heaven, but Esau did. If that is the case, then maybe the conflict that we have before us in the Middle East is the conflict of Esau and Jacob, and therefore the conflict in the Middle East must be a little bit more critical to us, because the animosity of Esau, Jacob, is going to increase, and we see it all over in every country of the Middle East. And likewise in the future, we are told that when Israel is being brought back, they would be fighting, that is Jacob and Judah, they would be fighting actually Edom, because the battle has not finished yet, and God himself will have the last holy war. Now, I don't have anything, as I said before, anything special against the Arabs. They are my cousins, we are all cousins, we are all family. We have to separate the sin from the man, but nevertheless, the hatred and the animosity there is not pleasant as long as it goes on, and shalom, that is salam in Arabic, will finally come to the Middle East. Until then, let's watch the Middle East and take all these prophecies into account, because the just might be true, and the just may tell us the real conflict and the real roots of the Middle East. Thank you very much for your patience. I'm sorry I went over time. As it is, I covered only about 10% of my material. Maybe some other time I'll have more. And for those who would like to have some inside information, I may be able to give you all the scriptures concerning this subject. Good night.